Millions of Texans turn out for week one of early voting in a state notorious for low turnout. A hint of a more fundamental change in Texas politics? That and more today on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. In this most unconventional election season, the state to watch is Texas, so declares veteran political journalist Dan Balls of The Washington Post. We'll ask him what makes Texas the most intriguing place in politics in the nation right now. Also, a rule change for social workers in the Lone Star State, dialing back anti-discrimination protections based on sexual orientation, gender identity, and disability. Many social workers call it a gut punch. Those stories and a whole lot more when the National News Show of Texas gets underway. And that happens right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 19th day of October 2020, the second week of early in-person voting in Texas, a week that by the standards of a typical general election year would be the one to pick if you're taking advantage of early voting in the general election. See, by midweek, the lines would be the shortest, or so goes the wisdom of Lone Star State political scholars. Alas, typical is not a word one should associate with election year 2020 in Texas, or anywhere else for that matter, and the lines for early voters have shown no sign of letting up, such as interest in this year's election season. The Texas Tribune reports that by the end of the day on Friday, more than 2,300,000 people had voted by mail or in person in Texas's 10 largest counties, where almost 60% of Texas's registered voters live. The conventional wisdom in this unconventional election year also suggests that it is mostly Democrats who are standing in those long lines and sending in those absentee ballots. The belief is they are especially activated to cast their ballot against a presidency they are intensely opposed to. And for the most part, that would be consistent with the national narrative. But that's not the whole story. Because in recent elections, the 10 biggest counties in Texas have also moved further to the left than the rest of the Lone Star State at large. And if it were up to those 10 counties alone, Texas would have both gone to Hillary Clinton in 2016, and Beto O'Rourke would be in the U.S. Senate instead of Ted Cruz by wide margins. These shifting dynamics indicate a Texas in political flux, and if you ask Dan Balls, chief political correspondent at the Washington Post, this is but one reason why in all of the U.S., Texas is the most intriguing political state in the Union. Indeed, let's ask Dan Balls more about his thesis, published in the Post over the weekend. Dan, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
What makes Texas the most intriguing political state in the country right now, by your reckoning?
Well, we know what the key battlegrounds are in this country, and we've known that for the better part of 4 years because of what happened in 2016. But if Texas were to shift, and I'm not predicting that, certainly, but if Texas were to shift and vote for Joe Biden, that would be such a seismic impact on the entirety of the politics of this year. The number of electoral votes that Texas has would break the back of President Trump. He would not be able to win the election. So what we've seen all year in Texas is it inching ever closer to being possibly something that the Democrats could flip. And having watched Texas politics for many, many years and have been skeptical of the Texas is about to turn blue narrative that some Democrats have pushed, watching it this year has been fascinating to me.
It's not just you that it's fascinating to. There are a whole lot of Texans who are trying to figure out just what it means, these long lines and the interest in absentee balloting as well. I must have received half a dozen emails in the last several days from listeners who have said, tell me what's really going on. What's the inside scoop? If someone were to ask you at a cocktail party or in an email, what would you tell them? What do you think is going on in Texas right now?
I would tell them that I don't know the answer to that, and for a couple of reasons. One is what we don't know about the long lines that we're seeing, and particularly the sense that this is, you know, many more Democrats than Republicans who are voting, is whether they are simply voting early, but it's the same pool of voters, or whether this is changing the nature of the composition of the electorate. And talking to some data experts that know these numbers better than I, they're quite cautious. One other reason is that we don't have ways to compare, not just in Texas, but in other states, exactly what's happening because states have changed the rules on how much time you can have for early voting and the absentee ballots. I know Texas is not, but in states they have. So there's no basis for comparison from prior years. So at this point, with only a week of early voting in Texas, you know, we're still flying a little bit blind. Certainly Democrats are encouraged by what they think they are seeing, but I don't know that they really have a definitive answer on that.
As someone who's watching all this from Washington, I think it's really fascinating that it's not just the presidential race that makes, at least to you, Texas so intriguing. What else are you looking at?
Well, the congressional races certainly are interesting. The Democrats picked up a couple of seats last time. Interestingly enough, the districts that are home to George W. Bush and the late George H.W. Bush both went for Democrats. Suburban areas, Houston, Dallas area. There are more of those kinds of districts that are at play this time. The Cook Political Report lists several that are toss-ups. Another, the Will Hurd seat in San Antonio to far west Texas, looks like it's likely to go Democratic. So what we're seeing is this pattern that you referred to early in the show, which is that the cities and now the suburban areas are moving toward the Democrats. And there are several reasons we know about. One is that the changing demographics. The other is the growth that's occurred in those areas. And the third is obviously President Trump, who has turned off suburban voters in Texas in the way that he's turned off suburban voters in other parts of the country, and particularly suburban women. So that's the dynamic that's affecting not just the presidential race in Texas, but also the congressional races and likely some of the state house races.
There's a whole lot more to check out in Dan Ball's story in the Washington Post. We'll have a link to it at texasstandard.org. Dan Ball, chief political correspondent for the Post, thanks so much for speaking with us on the Standard.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Dan was talking about the closely watched change in the suburbs of Texas, and among those races that tell us more about whether there's a fundamental shift, one playing out in Collin County, a longtime Republican stronghold. KERA's Brett Jaspers has more on the contest in Texas's 3rd congressional district.
Republican Van Taylor is a fixture in Collin County. Before winning the 3rd congressional district seat 2 years ago, he was a state lawmaker for 8 years. And before that,
you know, I started in politics as a precinct chair here in Plano. And watch out, because you never know where that's going to take you.
That was Taylor talking to volunteers in early October, before he went door-knocking asking for support.
Would you like a Van Taylor for Congress yard sign?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Throw that rascal up there. I've got a great yard for that, by the way.
Yes, you do.
John Hunt lives in Plano and voted for Taylor in 2018, aiding the congressman's 10-point victory. He told Taylor his big issue is President Trump's judicial nominations.
My faith is important to me, man.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a pro-life,
mm-hmm.
Reading as much as I possibly can about Amy Coney Barrett, and I'm really happy.
Taylor has been a reliable vote for President Trump in Congress, although he strikes a more moderate tone. He'll need it. Democrats are targeting this seat with the kind of health care message they think was so successful in 2018. On the Affordable Care Act, Taylor says he hears lots of complaints about high costs. To fight that, he wants to increase the number of people getting health care degrees.
You lower the cost of something by increasing the supply. So I'm very focused on the supply. That means reducing red tape, increasing the supply, and ultimately lowering healthcare costs to make it more affordable for everybody.
Premiums have risen since Obamacare went into effect, although many other provisions of it are popular. Taylor wouldn't say whether he agreed with the Texas lawsuit seeking to invalidate the law. The U.S. Supreme Court will hear the case just after the election. Taylor's competition in 2020 is Democrat Lulu Cycli. The Plano lawyer recently handed out yard signs to supporters.
To this day, I don't know how to delicately shut a trunk.
Like other Democrats, Cycli talks about health care a lot. And it's a winning message with people like Karen Mott.
I'm an RN of 37 years.
Oh, my mom is an RN.
So, yes, healthcare is why I became a Democrat and left the Republican Party.
Mott has employer-based coverage and doesn't buy on the Obamacare exchanges, but some of the ACA's other reforms have been crucial for her family.
I was able to keep both my children who were just in college on our health insurance until they were 26.
Karen Mutt isn't a persuadable voter, but college-educated women like her are where many campaigns are focusing their energy. Over half of the residents over 25 in this district have a four-year college degree, making it one of the most educated in the country. Cycli also talks about her personal story as a first-generation Lebanese American who has experienced racism.
What if a little girl who's feeling the way I felt after 9/11 is feeling the same way because we have a president who's in the White House, who's spewing all this hateful rhetoric.
The district has rapidly changed. It's become 5% less white since 2013 and gained almost 150,000 people. And Democrat Beto O'Rourke's near miss in the 2018 Senate race sent a message. Bernard Fraga at Emory University says talking directly to communities of color signals their vote matters.
When a group that is important to you, an identity that's important to you, is prioritized by campaigns, is really talked about by campaigns, that's when you're more likely to see higher voter turnout for members of that group.
Arash Paravin is Iranian-American and has seen a lot of change growing up here.
When I went to Plano and graduated with 1,400 kids, there's probably like 100 immigrants, or immigrants, but a non-white. And now you look at it, it's completely opposite.
But Paravin isn't familiar yet with his congressional choices, and in a year with a noisy presidential race and a cascade of down-ballot names, it'll be hard for any local campaign to break through. Van Taylor argues growth here proves the success of Republican governance. We'll see if voters agree. I'm Brett Jaspers in Plano.
Well, Dunbar is usually in this position, but Michael Marks is in for him on this Monday. Hello there, Michael.
Hey, David. Some news breaking out of Washington just before today's show that's got the Lone Star State talking. The U.S. Supreme Court added a couple cases of interest to Texans to its docket. The first one involves the wall being constructed along the U.S.-Mexico border. Trump versus Sierra Club challenges the administration's diverting military funding to finance that wall.
Oh, yeah.
High Court also accepted a case concerning the administration's policy on asylum seekers, specifically whether the federal government can force Mexican citizens seeking asylum in the U.S. to remain in Mexico while waiting for a court date and ruling. Should note these tweets by a friend of the show, Stephen Vladek, a federal court and con law professor at the University of Texas Law School. He says it's likely that these cases won't be heard until February 2021, possible that by then they'd be moot if Joe Biden were elected president. So, as they say, watch this space.
I was just going to say, yeah, I can't imagine the Supreme Court deciding those cases before the election. In any event, we would love to hear what's on your news radar, Texas. You know what to do. Look for Michael Marks at Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Michael will be back with more of the Talk of Texas in about 35 minutes or so.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Over 80,000 students in Houston are heading back to their classrooms today for the first time since March. Houston Public Media's Laura Isensee has more on the new normal at the state's largest school district.
Parents have had lots of questions about what exactly school will look like. So HISD held a phone bank last week to give answers.
Please give us a call. We're here for you for the next couple of minutes. 713.
Some details vary school by school, like where's lunch and class sizes. Michael LeClaire and Lon Ma say the decision to send their two boys back was tough. Their fourth grader is a little nervous. Their second grader...
He's very excited about going back. He just had been asking about his friends.
For Ma, it came down to the quality of their education. While her husband felt their kids were missing social interaction...
After a while, it really started to take a toll on our kids. You could just start to see the emotions becoming a little more raw as time went by.
If they decide to change, they and other HISD families can switch back to online learning at the next grading period. For now, they're trusting their neighborhood school. Educators, though, may need more reassurance. Over the weekend, more than 100 from around Houston sounded off their frustration with plans for face-to-face instruction, pulling up to the HISD headquarters in a car caravan. their request that the governor and education leaders do more to keep school communities safe during the COVID-19 pandemic. To get ready for in-person learning, teachers have stocked up on things like
face shield, 3 boxes of gloves, 2 packages of antibacterial wipes, and an extra package of disposable masks.
That's Daniel Santos. He teaches at Navarro Middle School and says he feels unprepared for the first time in 15 years.
I'm anxious. I'm demoralized. It's frustrating to me because I'm such an advocate for my students and for my community, and it just frustrates me.
Santos worries there's not enough protective gear and not enough teachers to keep kids spaced out. He originally had 11 desks. Now he's up to 14. Adding to his anxiety, trying to teach online and in person at the same time, and wondering how he'll find out if there are COVID cases on campus. His middle school is one of several HISD facilities that have already been exposed to COVID. So has Chavez High School, where Principal Luis Landa says he's taking school one step at a time.
It won't be exactly like it was before the pandemic, but one thing that we'll make sure of is that safety comes first and that we're going to continue to give 100% to make sure students do learn.
Just 20% of his 2,700 students are expected to return. That's half the district-wide total of 40%. Principal Landa says if Chavez High avoids more cases, it'll be his biggest win this year. I'm Laura Eisenstein in Houston.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Texas social workers will no longer be prohibited from turning away potential LGBTQ clients or people with a disability after the state's social work governing body changed a section of its code of conduct early last week. Governor Greg Abbott's office says the change was necessary to align with state law. Many social workers themselves are calling the move, among other things, a gut punch and incredibly disheartening. Matthew Watkins is the managing editor of News and Politics for the Texas Tribune. Matthew, welcome back to The Standard.
Hi, thanks for having me.
On the face of it, this sounds like a rollback in anti-discrimination protections, plain and simple. Who initiated this change in the rule?
Sure. Well, the change was recommended by Governor Abbott's office, according to board members who spoke to the Tribune last week. Basically, the reason that was stated from the governor's office, according to these board members, is because the code's non-discrimination protections, as you said, went beyond protections that are laid out in state law.
That's interesting because we've seen legal battles over whether a baker can refuse to make a cake for a gay couple, for example. How is it that a social worker now, in Texas at least, can turn away someone on the basis of sexual orientation with a mere change in a state professional rule?
Sure. Well, you know, this has been kind of a long fight in Texas over many years, you know, this idea of non-discrimination protections versus what many, you know, religious conservatives in the state, including our Republican leadership, has kind of touted as a religious liberty issue. I mean, their general argument in these debates, as they have come up in the legislature and elsewhere, is that if a person feels, you know, it is against their religion to provide services for, you know, as you mentioned with the cake, for a gay wedding or something like that, they shouldn't have to go against their religious beliefs in order to fulfill their job.
With this rule change, could the state be violating any federal laws here? I mean, what have the courts had to say about anti-discrimination at that level?
Yeah, you know, I think that there have been, you know, court rulings, of course, the gay marriage ruling being a big one. You know, the state has a gay marriage ban on its books that it obviously cannot enforce. So we would just kind of have to see how this court case would play out. Obviously, the Supreme Court and other federal courts in the country have grown more conservative in recent years, so it's hard for me to predict exactly how it would play out. But, you know, we can be pretty certain, I think, that there will be some legal challenges about this.
Question about whether or not the social workers themselves had any say here, because typically when you're talking about a professional rule, you have input from the people who would be directly affected by such a rule change, and those are the professionals themselves. What's the story there?
Yeah, we quoted a social worker from Houston in our story about this, who called this both a professional and a personal gut punch. And, you know, one of the big criticisms from social workers in Texas after this came out was that it was done without input from social workers that the state board oversees. You know, one of the big complaints is that this happened very quietly. A lot of people didn't learn about it until after the rule was actually changed.
Also, it's hard to overlook the fact that many people with issues related to sexual orientation or disabilities also struggle with issues related to mental health, too. And I wonder, what are advocates for the LGBTQ community and for people with disabilities having to say about this change?
Sure. I mean, I think that that is a big concern both for advocates within the community and for social workers and people who want to help this community. You know, it's no big secret that many in the LGBTQ community, you know, face mental health challenges, you know, in large part, you know, because of some of the discrimination and things that they face out there. So, you know, I think that there are a lot of people who see this rule and say, you know, this is going to be painful for people, and it's going to, you know, maybe make those feelings worse. That, you know, there are some people out there who don't make them feel kind of welcome in this state.
But of course, as Matthew was saying there, we are likely to see some legal challenges, and so this may not be the final word on the issue. You can keep up with all the latest over at texastribune.org. That's where Matthew Watkins is managing editor of News and Politics. We'll link to the latest from the Texas Tribune over at texasstandard.org. Matthew, thanks again.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, presenting the Intersect Ed podcast, where the stories of Texas public education policy and practice meet. Available at raiseyourhandtexas.org/podcast and most podcast platforms.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. As early voting continues, the Texas Secretary of State's office says nearly 17 million people are registered to vote. KERA's Rachel Osier-Lindley has more.
To be exact, 16,995,519 people are registered to cast ballots in the November election. That's a new state record. It also marks an increase of nearly 1.9 million voters from the last presidential election in 2016. The current early voting period runs through Friday, October 30th, and Election Day is Tuesday, November 3rd. I'm Rachel Osier-Lindley in Dallas.
And a spokesperson for the Texas Secretary of State said today more than 4 million Texans have already cast ballots early. More than half of the 254 counties in Texas are letting bars reopen at 50% capacity under a new order Governor Greg Abbott issued earlier this month. One of the latest is Cameron County in the Rio Grande Valley. It has reported the eighth most COVID-19 cases of any county in the state during the pandemic, with more than 23,000. County Judge Eddie Trevino Jr. on Friday urged bar owners, staff, and patrons to follow health guidelines.
In the event of documented infections at bars or similar establishments, or an increase in rates of cases or infections, this provision may be revoked.
Other counties in the Rio Grande Valley, such as Hidalgo and Starr, are holding off on reopening bars. Oilfield services giant Halliburton today announced a $17 million drop in revenue during the third quarter. It marks the fourth quarterly loss in a row for the Houston-based company. But the latest figure is a substantial improvement from the $1.7 billion loss reported in the second quarter due to plunging oil prices. On an investor call this morning, Chief Executive Officer Jeff Miller signaled optimism for the long term.
We're an oilfield services company, and we believe the world needs a lot of oil and gas for a very long time. And, you know, really, to the extent capital is shifted away by certain customers, more capital will be invested by others.
Revenue from Halliburton's North American operations fell 66% in the third quarter compared to the same time last year. Halliburton's stock value is down roughly 50% from the start of the year. And the Los Angeles Dodgers and the Tampa Bay Rays are playing the World Series in North Texas this week. LA defeated the Atlanta Braves Sunday night in Game 7 of the National League Championship Series. The two Major League Baseball teams will face off in the Texas Rangers' Globe Life Field in front of a limited number of fans. Game 1 is tomorrow. I'm Joseph Leahy.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the Texas Secretary of State. Providing voters details on which approved forms of photo ID they can take to the polls. More at votetexas.gov or 800-252-VOTE.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. The first week of early voting is in the books, and in the 10 biggest counties in Texas, turnout numbers are high, as we noted at the start of our broadcast. But this is not true everywhere in the Lone Star State. For instance, Hidalgo and Cameron counties in the Rio Grande Valley actually saw a dip in turnout last week. Which raises the question, just what is it that gets people to the polls or keeps them away? Well, a new book by journalist Aaron Geiger-Smith explores how we got the vote in the first place, how to get people to vote, and what to understand about your vote. It's called Thank You for Voting, The Maddening, Enlightening, Inspiring Truth About Voting in America. She joins us now. Aaron, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
I know you're originally from Texas Liberty, you were telling me, so you've kept a close tab on what's happening in the Lone Star State, I would imagine. What do you make of the record turnout in the larger counties in Texas?
You know, anytime we see a ton of people showing up to the polls and showing enthusiasm is exciting, but early voting turnout doesn't always tell us what happens at the end. So, you know, I think I'd say cautious optimism. It's exciting to see how huge these numbers are, especially in places like Harris County, which is really going above and beyond so far. But we have to keep a close eye on what it turns out to be.
Well, in your book, you talk about turnout, voting problems and solutions. And one thing you explore in depth is voting by mail. Say a little bit more about that, because that's not been such a prominent feature, at least in Texas politics, until this year, when it's become really, it's taken center stage.
Right, exactly. You know, when I was writing the book, I had no idea that vote by mail would become one of the hottest topics of the 2020 election. What really stood out to me when the pandemic started and vote by mail became such a hot topic was that, of course, those states who don't use it extensively don't realize how many other states do, that we have several states that have voted completely by mail and for a long time.
Let's talk a little bit about what's prompting a lot of people to mail in their ballots this year. Pandemic, right? I mean, but in a non-pandemic year, what do you think keeps people away from the polls and what can be done to address this? I mean, I guess that's really at the heart of a lot of what you're talking about in this book. Why is it that the franchise, so hard won, is something that is not more universally taken advantage of?
Right. I mean, what I hoped when I began researching the book, what I would discover this one big problem and we could just solve that one and we would be off. But the truth is, of course, that it's a ton of reasons. There's barriers for some people. There are many reasons that young people specifically stay home. So young people, our ages 18 to 29, have really low turnout. And that's what I spent a lot of time looking at in the book. And a lot of people think it's apathy, but it's really not. Young people care a ton about their education and being able to get a job and maybe climate change. And especially in 2018, there was a large focus on safety in schools. But what I really felt like was that we're not doing a good job of teaching people how to vote. That, I think, it's failure to teach the mechanics and then not making voting as convenient as possible. You know, long registration cutoffs. So states like Texas that cut off voter registration 30 days before the election, whereas some states have same-day registration. I think we need to look at those factors of convenience and try to do better about working those into our system.
I wonder, though, how much about the system itself
becomes a kind of psychological impediment. There are some folks who say, well, my vote doesn't count because of, for instance, the Electoral College. Does that notion Sure. have merit when it comes to thinking about why people do or don't choose to vote?
I think it absolutely does. A question that I get over and over is, I live in an all red state or I live in an all blue state. What does it matter if I vote? And that also goes to the fact that we don't do a great job of explaining that the Electoral College matters only about the president, and you are going to vote up and down the ballot. So even if you live in an all red state or an all blue state, your vote very much matters in all of the elections below the presidential election. So I think trying to teach this idea of you're not just voting for president, you have to look at your senators, your congresspeople, very much your state legislatures and your mayors and city council people and school board. I think if the coronavirus has taught us anything, it's that local and state officials have a huge effect on our lives.
An important primer on voting in an important election year, Erin Geiger-Smith explores America's voting processes in her new book, Thank You for Voting, The Maddening, Enlightening, Inspiring Truth About Voting in America. Erin, I wish we had more time. Thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks so much for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU. Stories of Horned Frog changemakers like Amiso George, who is helping organizations navigate COVID-19 crisis communications, can be found at tcu.edu/teamwork. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, with a reminder that October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. To aid early detection, all women over the age of 40 should undergo routine screening, like yearly mammograms. More at texasoncology.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I am Francoise Wilson, and I live just outside of Kerrville. Even while they were telling us, the authorities were telling us, you know, you don't need to wear a mask, I'd be like, I don't know. So I was wearing one even when they said we didn't need to. So I'd say early March. Well, I first started making my own with bandanas. I really liked the way that the Surgeon General, you know, did that really quick video where he showed how easy it was. So I was cutting up T-shirts and using bandanas and, you know, doing, you know, some folding magic and all that sort of thing. And that's why it was so cool. But after that, I found the HED masks, which are my favorite. You know, I started wondering, I liked the sequins. And I liked the, you know, the painted on stuff, but those kind of things, after a few washings, they fall off. So I was wondering, you know, I can't sew anything, I can't glue anything, I can't paint anything because it'll come off. But how about if I just clip something on, and then a light went off and it was like, you know, clip on earrings. Here we go. So where do you get clip on earrings? Estate sales. So that's what I started looking for, and I found some really cool ones. I do get some comments. And, you know, if I wear them to the grocery store, which is probably the only thing I do anymore when I leave the house, is I'll get looks. And you can tell the people are smiling from behind their masks, mostly women. Once in a while, little kids will ask, you know, point and ask me, like, you know, what's that? I do field work every Monday. So I have to do a lot of talking, and we're outside, and it's hot. So once in a while, there is a sweat factor, but it's, you know, you just, you know, you power through it. You know, you just keep it on. Now, mind you, when I'm out in the field, I don't wear my glamour. But other than that, you know, it's really not a problem. You do what you got to do. I have about 6 of those black HED masks. I will probably put them in with the journal that I have been keeping since the start. You know, package them up and stick them in the journal there. That's all part of the story. When I lived abroad, I would keep a journal, but, you know, for the everyday, not normally. But I knew that from early on that we were going to be living through history. This is all, we're living history now. People will talk about this like they talk about the pandemic back in, you know, 100 years ago. So, you know, newspaper clippings and comics that refer to it as a record of this experience. I noticed that recently people have started getting kinder. You know, they're more patient. They're
more generous with their time and with their efforts for another person. Like if you're crossing in the crosswalk, you know, people will wait, they'll let you go ahead. I'd say that, you know, the masks are all a factor in this history that we're living through now of what your community means to you and to what we all mean to each other. My name is Suslaz Wilson. I live just outside of Kerrville, and you are listening to the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is collecting stories from Texans about their masks. Help us keep track of this moment in history by sharing your experiences. Look for us on social media or send us an email, texasstandard@kut.org. This year brought Desiree Venecia a wave of interest in her work. The Dallas painter was among the muralists filling the city with art during the height of the protests against police violence. When she's not painting, Venecia is in the classroom, teaching middle school art. As KERA's Art and Seek unit continues its series highlighting black artists, reporter Miguel Perez spoke with Venecia about her many influences.
Black women are at the foundation of Desiree Venecia's work. The painter was raised in a matriarchal home, and her work often looks to the women in her own life, like her mom.
When I was buying a house, I made sure that I stayed like within 15 minutes of her house. But then also I see my grandma all the time, and my great-grandmother, I haven't been able to see her because of COVID, but I talk to her as much as I can.
Her portraits, both strong and vulnerable, pay homage to her family and challenge stereotypes of black women. One of her latest pieces currently hangs at the Fort Worth Community Arts Center. Simple, clean lines and stark black paint set against a baby blue backdrop.
I want to see the arch of the eyes and the way the lips are formed. And is the hair in front of the ears or is it pinned up? And each of those details kind of play a huge part into like what I'm trying to say with the piece.
Every brush stroke is deliberate, and every painting starts off on paper as a poem or a thought that becomes a sketch, that becomes a blueprint.
When I'm in the zone, I'm like focused. Even though like there might be a kid screaming in the background or I have lesson plans to finish, my face is completely focused on that. And I don't break away until it's done.
It requires total discipline, and that's challenging. She has a 4-year-old son, and she has about 350 art students at J.L. Long Middle School in East Dallas. Her days start early and end late, filled with lesson plans, car rides, back-to-back classes.
And then I go home. I say it out loud, and I'm like, oh my God, I do too much.
But her ambition is undeterred. The self-made artist has been on this path for 5 years now.
I just turned 25 and I was probably 4 months pregnant. And I said, I want to do something with my life that my son will be proud of.
She says this year especially has been pivotal for her career as an artist. Her work got a big boost of attention after a mural she painted in Deep Ellum this summer, honoring the lives of black men and women killed by police, was featured in the paper.
Somebody took a picture of it before it hit Dallas Morning News, and then it was just like off from there. And it was insane.
A flood of requests followed. New commissions, social media takeovers, panel talks, and gallery shows. But Venecia says some of the interest felt insincere.
We're going to give you these opportunities, but we don't want you to say anything. And so it's kind of like they're letting us down in the sense like, you just want to use my face. You just want to use my credentials or who I am to better your narrative. But you're not listening to me as far as the things that you need to do in order for your institution to be better.
Venecia is learning to navigate the professional art world, talking to the press, saying no to bad deals, and sharing her ideas without restraint.
I have definitely just been like, nope, this is what my work is about. This is what it stands for. I've become very, I don't know how to say this, I guess possessive in a sense.
Her success comes at a moment fraught with uncertainty. The pandemic has not been kind to her creativity.
I'm really going through the most stressful time in my life. I'm having more panic attacks than I can. I'm literally having like moments where I just cannot function for the day. But I had to push through because it's just like at the end of the day, I don't want to be confined.
So she soldiers on. Venecia is not wasting the momentum 2020 has given her. She's already planning her next big move.
Okay, I'm going to tell you my goal, and it's going to be insane. But I want to run for Board of Trustees for Dallas ISD, or I want to be a board member for the Dallas Museum of Art.
A feasible, if ambitious, goal for an artist, a teacher, and a mother with little left to prove. Like always, she'll turn to the women in her paintings for help.
My mom had always been my rock, and my grandma had always been my rock. And so growing up in that, it was just, you realize that, you know, there's only things that you can do, and there's only things that you can do in order for your family to be successful.
Venezia is defining that success on her own terms and in her own time. I'm Miguel Perez in Dallas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at SaveNowForCollege.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at WhiteMountainFoods.com, available in the dairy aisle.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Lubbock's mayoral elections are usually low-key affairs, but COVID-19 pushed what's usually a May election into the fall. Texas Tech Public Media's Sarah Self-Walbrick reports on how a typically sleepy race was turned on its head.
As the city council headed into a regular meeting last month, more than 100 people gathered in front of Lubbock's Citizens Tower for a rally. Maybe a dozen wore masks, and kids ran around with signs and balloons. The group is organizing to make Lubbock a sanctuary city for the unborn. The area's state representatives have submitted a city ordinance for consideration that would make abortion unlawful in Lubbock. It's currently under legal review. A similar ordinance has been adopted in 15 Texas cities, none the size of Lubbock.
Isn't this the protection of the unborn the most important ordinance we can have?
The group sprung to action in September after Planned Parenthood of Greater Texas announced it's returning to Lubbock after closing in 2013. The agency says abortion will not immediately be offered at the clinic, which is set to open later this year.
It's like, wow, like who thought this would be the defining moment of the mayoral election here in Lubbock, Texas?
That's Texas Tech University political science professor Nathaniel Wright. He says there was no predicting a controversial issue like this would come up this election. Incumbent Dan Pope identifies as conservative and says he's personally pro-life. But under current city orders, there's really not much the local government can do to keep Planned Parenthood out.
I think we'll take one step at a time, and we'll try to do it in a way that's respectful, that respects the city charter. I took an oath to uphold the city charter and the Constitution of the United States of America, and I'm going to do my very best to act in that way.
Pope is one of only a handful of Lubbock mayors to seek a third tenure. Before running for the office, he spent 9 years on the Lubbock ISD school board.
There's always work to be done. I think you can always say that. That can be a bit trite. But I do believe that there are a number of projects that we've begun that I would like to see through.
Challenger Stephen Sanders is a local musician who ran as a write-in candidate for mayor in 2018. He says he's led by his Christian faith on this issue and others.
I'm not okay with Planned Parenthood. I'm never going to be. And it's non-negotiable. And so if I'm elected and we don't get it through to make it a sanctuary city, I'm going to make sure that we get it on the agenda so that we can vote on it, you know, and just let the voices be heard.
Sanders has never held office before, but says God told him to run for mayor. If elected, he'd be the first African-American in the job. In Texas, municipal elections are traditionally nonpartisan, but Sanders is a vocal supporter of President Donald Trump.
When it comes down to it, my religious beliefs line up with the conservative values. I have to be true to who I am.
Professor Wright says Sanders' alignment with the president has given this political outsider a boost. In 2016, 66% of Lubbock County voters cast their ballot for President Trump.
Both candidates now are really kind of like acting as if they're running on a national platform, right? Because you have Stephen Sanders, who is really pro-Trump. You know, Mayor Pope is very much moderate.
Wright says having local races on the same ballot as a tumultuous presidential election has further politicized this race.
And I think a lot of people are associating a lot of their issues, right, national issues with local issues. Right, so that's another layer that we've never seen before.
Mayor Pope says delaying the May municipal elections was the right thing to do at that point of the pandemic. And Sanders says he appreciates the extra time to campaign. I'm Sarah Self-Walbrick.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. We got Michael Marks monitoring the talk of Texas on this Monday. He's in for Wells Dunbar. Hello there, Michael.
Hey, David. Did you have a good weekend?
Yeah, I did. How about yours?
It was solid. It was solid. I did not do what apparently many other folks did, which was vote. We've been hearing all about these astounding early voting totals in Texas. Most recent numbers from the Secretary of State's office show over 4 million ballots cast during the first week of early voting. KUT's Ashley Lopez puts that in perspective for us a bit. She tweets that's comparable to the population of the entire state of Oregon. It's a big state, baby.
Yeah, that is. Dan Solomon over at Texas Monthly put it somewhat more succinctly. He says the early voting numbers in Texas are bonkers. Bonkers, I believe, is the descriptive word there.
Off the
charts. The difficult thing here is what it does and doesn't tell us. I can't tell you how many people have reached out over the weekend and said, what do you make of this? I don't think anyone really knows what to make of it. If it represents a lot of Democrats disaffected with this administration, upset with policies of Donald Trump and that sort of thing, or, you know, it's tough to say exactly what it is. People are waiting. Yeah, we'll just have to see how it all sorts out.
I don't think we will know until after Election Day. Of course, some folks are going to wait until then to vote. That includes Luanna Campbell. She writes on the Texas Standard Facebook page, something about that Election Day feeling. I will vote then, but rest assured, no matter how long the line is, I will be there. Others reacting to the big early voting totals include Senator John Cornyn, who tweeted today, who says voting in Texas is hard? #vote. Maybe he was listening to our conversation with Erin Geiger-Smith earlier about her book on the hurdles many folks have to jump through to get to the polls.
Absolutely. I think that one of the points that she was making, which I found really interesting, was that we talk a lot about the civic virtue of voting, but we don't talk about the mechanics of voting, what it takes to actually qualify, to get on the ballot, to cast the ballot. It's just something that's not really discussed much in school, and nor is a lot of the history of the franchise and how hard fought those battles were to get the right to vote.
Absolutely. It's so easy. You know, the sloganized version of, just go vote. That's what I remember being taught in schools. Very little of our conversation that we heard earlier. Wanted to bring this up before we left, David, real quick. If you're planning your evening's entertainment and a fan of Texans playing football, not necessarily Texas football, tonight is your night. Monday Night Football tonight with the Dallas Cowboys and Arizona Cardinals features Andy Dalton of the Cowboys, who played for TCU and Katy High School. And for the Cardinals, it's Kyler Murray, who won 3 state championships at Allen High School. And, of course, Murray is coached by a Texas Tech great and former New Braunfels High School unicorn. Yes, the unicorns, David. Cliff Kingsbury. And the game is being played in Dallas. So Texas, 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 football, football, football. Who's not a fan?
Yeah, there you go. I know a few people who aren't fans. I think a lot of people have been sort of wondering about, the return of high school football and college football and the wisdom thereof and all of that.
Of course,
but yes, of course, of course, yeah, absolutely. Listen, the clock's ticking away on us here at the big broadcast, but the news continues 24/7 over at texasstandard.org. Michael Marks has been monitoring social media, and he will continue to do so, keep those comments coming in. We'll be back here on the radio tomorrow, and we hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with the rest of the Texas Standard team, wishing you a marvelous start of your work week.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, proud to be a founding sponsor of the Texas Standard on public radio. Texas Mutual is a policyholder-owned workers' comp provider working to bring wellness into the workplace. More at texasmutual.com. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.